All right. Thanks everyone for coming. I will try to give a brief overview of a series of topics that are introduced by in the last decade by Laurent Friedel, Leif Molin, George Minich, Rob Lee, and their collaborators. And I will also talk about its possible applications in particle physics and cosmology. An overview, it's also an overview of my talk. I will talk about these topics, come to the concept of metaparticles at the end, it's subject of ongoing research. This red area is the area that I'm working on. I will start talking about the background and go into this direction. And I'll rush in the beginning and give more details here, but you can ask questions anytime if you want more detail. All right, so. Remind me, well, as always. Okay, preliminary concepts, relative locality. As motivation, think of how we perceive or observe the space-time. We make local measurements of events or interactions, their energy, their momenta. So we have access to energy momentum, and we built the space-time from this information operationally. And here we assume the linearity of momenta. But what if we question this? What if the space of possible values of energy and momentum is not a flat vector space, but a manifold? Then we end up with a curved momentum space, or more generally, we have curvature in the whole phase space. And we consider not the space-time as a manifold that the objects are living on, but the whole phase space, and we add a curvature to the whole phase space. But there's a distinct notion of the space-time different from the momentum space that we observe. So what is the space-time? So space-time should be thought as a slice of this phase space, which will be observer dependent, depending on the energy or momentum at which it is of the observer. So different observers will construct different space-time differently, and they just as simultaneity becomes relative in special relativity. Locality of distant events becomes relative in the framework of relative locality. And the observable effects will depend on energy over Planck mass, presumably. So this is an explanation, just like in special relativity, the effects are proportional to speed over the speed of light. So this is the corresponding scale, which will explain why we don't observe these effects in the nature every day. So if thinking about this, these effects depend on the Planck mass. So even in the so-called relative locality regime, which is when we take h bar go to zero and the g go to zero, while they're proportional if held fixed, these effects may be observable. There's a proposal that this effect relates to can explain the time delay in gamma ray bursts. Okay, and second background topic, Born reciprocity. The idea is that, I mean, Max Born proposed this idea as a principle in 1936 and said that the the validity of quantum mechanics implies a fundamental symmetry between space and momentum, as position operators, momentum operators are just different operators in a Heisenberg or Weyl algebra, and so it seems to be there seems to be a symmetry between them. But a general relativity seems to break the symmetry. Why? Well, general relativity says the space-time is curved, but the momentum space is the cotangent space of this curved manifold, which by assumption is flat. So Born argues that in order to unify quantum theory of gravity, we have to extend this notion into a phase space by allowing the whole phase space to have curvature. So this is a neat idea, but how can we realize this? How does the mathematics work? Well, it turned out to be complicated or elusive for a long while, but there's a recent proposal by Laurent Fredel, George Minich, and Rob Lehm called metastring theory, which is that we actually, which says that we actually find find a realization of these principles inside string theory. If only we allow some arguably less fundamental assumptions in string theory, such as locality in particular. This realizes the relative locality and Born reciprocity. It is also, it's a generalization of string theory. It says that string theory should be understood as a non-commutative theory in phase space, where the target space is a section, is a Lagrangian submanifold or a configuration space built of the phase space, which I will give examples of. And it is non-commutative. Interestingly, we find non-commutativity not only in metastring theory, but also in the zero modes of usual closed string theory, which is an interesting relation. The Born reciprocity is realized, is connected to T-duality in this framework. Just as Born reciprocity is a duality between momentum and space, which is like you invert the scale from infrared to ultraviolet, and also in T-duality, the duality between the close and the long and the large compactifications, and this can be understood as a Fourier transform in the phase space. New concept, modular space. Modular space is the target space of metastring theory, and I will talk about that in more detail. The geometrical structure of metastring theory, which is also found in modular space, and I'll talk about it, is called Born geometry after Max Born. All right, so let's talk about the details. Okay, so let's start with, now I'm going to talk about the main part and I'll give a bit more detail. Let's think about the Heisenberg algebra, the algebra of position and momentum operators as we know it. So we have an algebra, a non-commutative star algebra. And there's a theorem called Gelfand-Neumann theorem, which says that by choosing a commutative subalgebra, we can this is isomorphic to there's a space called Gelfand space, this is isomorphic to. So, roughly speaking, choosing a commutative subalgebra gives us a space of polarization. For example, we can choose the generator Q only. So not all the operators generated by Q and P both, but only those that are generated by Q. Q commutes with itself, so everything in the subalgebra commutes with themselves. So we can associate to this commutative subalgebra a space, which is the flat Euclidean space, which is just the usual configuration space we know. We can instead, as a second example, choose P, which will give us the momentum space. So this is one side of Born's argument why space and momentum space should, in principle, be no different from a quantum mechanical perspective, because it's just a different choice of a polarization. So can we choose, what else can we choose? Can we choose both Q and P at the same time? This is not possible because they don't commute, so we cannot get the whole phase space. But we can choose these two operators. These two operators, exponentials of Q and P for and given an arbitrary length scale L, commute with each other. This is remarkable from the perspective of classical physics, because there's no analog of this relation in terms of Poisson brackets. So this is a purely quantum phenomenon. So these are called modular observables, and we can choose the algebra. So we have not one but two generators in this case. So they will give us a two-dimensional space. You can extend it to higher dimensions, and but these are the eigenvalues of these operators are on a circle, are on the unit circle. So you can already get the idea that the configuration space of the modular observables will be compact. Indeed, if we choose these generators, we get what is called modular space. It's a torus of size L times 2 pi h bar over L. And you can think of it as cutting an area in the phase space that has the area 2 pi h bar, and compactifying it into a torus. There's more subtlety, but I'm not going into it. Should be thought as a generalization of configuration space. I mean, it's just a different choice of polarization. The interpretation of these observables, so what they mean physically, is Aharonov-Bohm phases. So if you have a beam of particles going through many slits and there's a phase difference between them, these observables measure those phase differences. Interestingly, in the limits when L goes to infinity, you get the, so in the limit when L goes to infinity, you get the position space, the usual configuration space. And in the limit L goes to zero, you get the momentum space, which are singular limits in the sense that they have the topology becomes degenerate. So a bit more detail. Let's introduce the dimensionless position, momentum, and the phase space vectors. And we introduce modular vectors. The reason we do this in this way is because they diagonalize the modular observables, as we expect. So we have a commutative subalgebra built out of these two observables. So because they commute, they can be diagonalized simultaneously. And Indeed, this is a modular vector written in terms of position vectors in the Schrödinger representation. So x plus n is just a position with some phases that depend on the momentum and a sum. And these vectors turn out to be simultaneous eigenvectors of the modular observables. And these vectors are quasi-periodic. So think of X, capital X, as a position on the modular space. On this, you had the square and compactified it. So if you go around the torus and make one loop, you get the same vector with a face. And so you can put a connection onto it and measure it and different gate choices. In this simplest example, the modular vectors constitute a complete nth normal basis. So if you take all modular vectors with their labels on the modular space, you get a complete nth normal basis of the same Hilbert space. Same Hilbert space in the sense that this Hilbert, this representation is unitarily equivalent to the Schrödinger representation, which is guaranteed by the Stone von Neumann theorem. So there are this is the general idea. What is significant about it, if it is just unitarily equivalent, so is there new physics that can arise from this? Well, it generalizes the notion of classical space to a quantum concept. So what it means from a quantum mechanical perspective and how differently it can be chosen. And recall that the Schrödinger representation, which is taking the position basis and writing the wave functions as functions of position, is just a special case of the whole set of modular representations. So it's fair to call this a generalization. The modular space contains more geometric structure than the flat Euclidean position space, because it, which is in this case a degenerate limit. The geometric structure is called the Born geometry, and it takes the geometrical structure of the phase space, like the Hamiltonian function or the symplectic structure, which I will talk in a moment. One thing very important about this is that it admits a fundamental length scale or momentum scale while preserving Lorentz symmetry. So this is not an approximation. The symmetry is preserved exactly, and this is so far the only way that does this in an exact way. If we compare, for example, loop quantum gravity, Lorentz symmetry is obtained in the continuum limit, or there are some examples like Kappa Poincaré or doubly special relativity, which modify Lorentz symmetry, but it's the same in a certain regime. But this admits a fundamental length scale while preserving Lorentz symmetry. So that's something unique. And if we look at the modular vectors, it's a superposition. A modular eigenvector is a superposition of vectors in the position basis, so it's non-local. And the fields that are polarized on the modular space will be non-local from the perspective of usual field theory on the configuration space, and vice versa. So this mixes locality and non-locality and gives it a chance to be, give locality a chance to be observer dependent, because the scale, you can think of the scale of a modular scale as determined by your system or by the observer. So for example, in if you have, again, a many slit experiment, it can be the spacing between your slits that determines the scale of your modular space.
One question, like you're talking about two notions of the scale. So you're saying there's, it meets a fundamental scale.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're also talking about observer dependent locality.
Yes.
So that would be like the scale would be somehow attached to a particular situation or an observer.
Yes, as in relative locality.
Are those scales just like the same thing mathematically and you just like can view them as like a fundamental scale or observer?
By fundamental, well, when I use the word fundamental, I mean it is in the definition of the, so it's a, when you just take a torus, for example, it is not rotation symmetric. It is the non-commutativity of the phase space that rescues the Lorentz symmetry in this case. So you can put into it in an observer-dependent way, or in a theory of quantum gravity, it can also be the Planck scale, for example.
Yeah, so it's just this L.
Yes, yes, exactly.
L, and you can think of it as fundamental.
Yes, exactly, exactly, in both ways.
Yeah. So when you're talking about X and P, are you thinking about three-dimensional things?
What I wrote down here was just one-dimensional, but the three or n-dimensional generalization is straightforward.
Well, yeah, but my question is in your operator X, are you considering an entrance that is time, or just is it time-dependent?
Okay. There are several different approaches to that, so I don't have a general answer, but for example, in double field theory, which has the same idea, the time is taken to be compact, but also from a different perspective. So it's an open question, I would say. I am doing it here only for the space and not time, yes. So talking about mixing locality and non-locality, I will briefly go into briefly talk about my PSI essay, let's consider the Hamiltonian operator for harmonic oscillator, where H is a metric and omega is a frequency scale. So we know about the Feynman path integral, where the transition amplitude between two position eigenvectors can be at different times, can be expressed by slicing the all possible paths into infinitesimal time slices as a functional integral over all these possible paths, weighted by the exponential of a classical action. So I did the same in the modular representation. So let's compare them. We have a transition amplitude between two position, between two modular eigenvectors. We expressed it as a functional integral, but there's a sum over a lattice, which can be interpreted as winding numbers. So because the space over which these paths go is compact and not simply connected, so in the Feynman case, they start from X, x0, go to xf. In this case, they start from x0, go to xf plus this w, which is interpreted as the winding. So it can go without winding, make a winding and go, and it is separated into this different, the possible set of paths is separated into by their winding numbers. And there's a phase governing the different winding numbers. And then there's a new action. So what is interesting, one interesting point about this is that we don't have one path integral, we have a sum of functional integrals. So we can, if we ask what is the classical trajectory, what is the stationary trajectory? There's a stationary trajectory that goes without winding. If you think it on a torus, you can draw a straight line with no winding. You can draw a straight line with one winding, two windings, windings in the other direction. So there are infinitely many classical paths. Classical in the sense that they are saddle points of the action. So this gives us an idea about how the choice of a basis of the Hilbert space that we consider as non-local, as having superpositions, is manifested as a non-trivial topology of the configuration space that it corresponds to. In this case, a torus, or it can be more complicated. There are more complicated examples that I worked on, like an orbifold case, and this, in turn, is manifested as a degeneracy in the classical limit. So, whether there's not one path, but many paths due to this non-trivial topology of the configuration space. The actions, I said they are different. So the usual action of a harmonic oscillator in the Schrödinger representation, and we get something different in the modular representation. A is the symplectic potential. H tilde is a combination of the metric H in the Hamiltonian together with the symplectic structure. And if we look at the equations of motions, this is the classical equation of motion, which gives us the phase space trajectory of a harmonic oscillator is an ellipse around the center of the phase space, where I is the complex structure. From this action, we find something compatible but different. We find the same with an extra time derivative. So this gives a freedom of this middle point. Where you had in the classical space this trajectory between any two points, you have now, if this is the modular space, you can translate it with one extra winding. You have an additional classical trajectory and then an additional one. You find infinitely many circles, as implied by the equation of motion. The phase space structure is very different. As I said, that the phase space of the as the geometric structure of the modular space is more rich. In the usual, this is the symplectic potential, and this is the symplectic form of the usual phase space in Schrödinger polarization, we find from this action, analyzing this action in its phase space structure, we find additional variables, let's call it capital P, that are defined in this way. And we find a phase space with twice the number of dimensions. This is the symplectic potential of that new phase space with this symplectic form. The Hamiltonians, this is the usual one, this is the new one. I won't go into details, they are different. So let's talk about the Born geometry. As in the modular space, we consider a doubled spacetime, or as in many other approaches as well. So we x, and in this case, x also includes the time. If you can take the Born geometry to be Lorentzian Born geometry or Euclidean Born geometry, both work. And there's a symplectic form. In its simplest form, you can write it like this. This is the symmetry group of this structure, and the symplectic form measures contains information about the quantum. It tells us what the commutation relations are. Together with a polarization metric, these two together define a bilagrangian structure which allows you to split the phase space in a unique way into what you call momentum and space and what you call polarization space. This has a split signature orthogonal symmetry group. And then there's finally a generalized metric, as it is called in double field theory, which in its simplest form is in this structure. So if it is, the examples I give here are Euclidean. In the Lorentzian case, this is 2, 2d minus 2. And these three symmetry groups intersected. The intersection of all these three is OD or O1D minus 1, which is the Lorentz group. So it is exactly the Lorentz group that preserves all these structures at the same time. And the idea of Born geometry is that these are just examples. In general, we want to make all these three structures dynamical. There are some compatibility conditions, which I won't go into detail, between these three structures. I'll talk about the recent developments. So in a paper by Laurent, David Svoboda, and Felix Rudolph, David is also a PhD student here, a unique Born connection for the Born geometry has been developed. Talking about the action and how to make these three structures dynamical. Well, there's a close relationship. Born geometry can be thought as a generalization of another theory, the double field theory, which has a very similar structure. H is dynamical, but eta is not dynamical, and omega is not existent. And double field theory has an action. So the idea is to generalize this action with all the three structures being dynamical. And applications, once we have the action, we can solve it for cosmology, for spherical symmetric solutions, and it will have a wide range of possible applications. All right, so this was Born geometry. I won't talk about double field theory. And I want to go now into outlook, what comes next. Okay. First, what are metaparticles? Why did I come here to this talk? Well, metaparticles is there's no published work so far about what metaparticles are. There are papers about metastrings, and metaparticles can be thought as a particle limit of the metastrings. Also having this double space structure, Born geometry, living perhaps on modular spaces. So if you consider it as a field theory, its arguments won't be in the moment in the usual position space, but in this double space with some extra conditions, usually called section condition, that restricts it in a dynamical way to what is called Lagrangian submanifold, or a slice of this double space. So metaparticles is something under development. There's a paper by George Minich in which this is considered for cosmology in a modified gravity or dark matter setting, and given some clues. So given that this is under development, but we have an idea of where it is going, what does it promise us? What can we expect from it? What is in the sky? This is my perspective on the topic, on the question. First of all, considering the old particles, well, we don't expect only some new particles or some new effects, new fields, but also in the usual fields of the standard model, electrons, neutrinos, quarks, they should, in this framework, all be able to be written as a metaparticle or as a particle in this double spacetime. And this has been done, I think, this year by a group in China, or last year, that they've written the standard model in the double field theory setting, which is a precursor of Born geometry. So it's open, ongoing work. And this, we can expect new effects from the same particles, the same fields, more degrees of freedom, same fields again, but also new particles. George Minich argues in his paper that the metaparticles obey Bose-Einstein statistics, not the Dirac-Fermi statistics, but a third kind that is called the infinite statistics. There are some arguments about that. It's not solved yet. So we can expect most exotic species, and they can be relevant for being dark matter candidates, or be observable in cosmology or in accelerators. But also, if we apart from having new particles, building some particle physics framework, we will have a generalization of the Einstein-Hilbert action in this double framework, and this can have an important implications for modified gravity, where the problem is we have this discrepancy in the halos of galaxies, but what if they are not particles, but particles that we don't observe, but that our theories of gravity should be modified if they imply a setting in which GR is not consistent with the observation. This is a second perspective to the dark matter problem, and this has been recently well, in since in the last decade, there are some papers about what is called Mondian dark matter by George Minich and his collaborators. And then there's the cosmological constant problem. If you if you have looked into modified gravity, the critical scale is an acceleration scale, which is connected to the observed value of the cosmological constant. And this cosmological constant, or this new, this acceleration scale, can be an evidence of a scale in this in this broader theory of gravity that they can have common origins. And there's ongoing research about it. I won't go into that detail. And then early universe cosmology. We have FRW spacetime coming from the cosmological principle, the homogeneity and isotropy as in the solutions of the Einstein-Hilbert action. Since we have now a more broader action with more degrees of freedom, even in the simplest setting of an exactly homogeneous and isotropic universe, we can have more degrees of freedom and more effects. And this has been explored in the setting of double field theory by, in particular by Robert Brandenburger and McGill, in what is called string gas cosmology. It's because double field theory is a truncation of string theory, and so this can be thought as coming from string theory in a more non-stringy perspective. And this work is also ongoing, and I will leave this here. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks. So, questions from the audience?
So you have this bigger metric that acts like in this bigger space, right? Where you
yes.
have positions and momentum. So do you know which are the equations of motion that this metric is gonna obey?
So in the setting of double field theory, where the basic idea is to take omega as constant, eta as constant, h as dynamical, and you get the double field theory. So this generalized metric contains the Einstein metric plus the B field of string theory. And it also has dilaton degrees of freedom. So it looks exact. The action of double field theory looks exactly like the Einstein-Hilbert action, with where D is dilaton, actually a generalized dilaton with another definition. But the definition of this R is different from R in general relativity. You restrict all fields to be independent of the second set of coordinates, this R reduces to the R of GR. And you get Einstein-Hilbert action. So this is a direct generalization of the gravity action, where again, these two are held constant. So what should come next is to generalize this action in which these objects are also dynamic. This is missing.
Do you know what curvature means in this momentum space? Like in the part that it's not space, in the second coordinates?
Mm-hmm. You can define Christoffel symbols, the connection, and I mean the notion of manifold is argued by Zwiebach and Olaf Holm to be different from the usual Riemannian setting because of a different definition of the Lie derivative. But the definitions of curvature is still quite analogous to the usual Riemannian geometry.
But is there a physical interpretation of it?
I mean, it is... I don't see it as different... So it can, for example, lead to observable effects of relative locality because it will be a curvature in this dual space. So this may be a physical interpretation. And the observable effects of this can be time delay in distant events, depending on their frequencies, or even they being the two beams being observed coming as from different angles, which is called dual gravitational lensing. So it is like gravitational lensing, but it is due to the curvature of this dual space. I hope that answered.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you were talking about this degenerate classical paths,
mm-hmm.
and I was wondering if you have any idea of how you would interpret that, or if it would be observable in any sense.
Let's look at... many slit experiment where the beam comes and propagates through these slits. And in the, so from the Schrödinger perspective of Schrödinger representation, the incoming beam is in a superposition of going through this slit or any of these slits. These interfere with each other. So there's, because it is not localized, there's no classical trajectory from the perspective of Schrödinger representation. But if we take the same, if we write this in the modular space, modular representation, assuming that this is infinitely long, the space in this vertical direction is a modular space. And the incoming beam at the initial point is localized. So we can talk about the classical trajectory that this will take. And if we consider as the endpoint this, we find there's a classical trajectory between them, like this, with zero winding. But there's another classical trajectory like this, with one winding, and so on. So suddenly, we can talk about classical trajectories because it is localized in the initial state and localized in the end state, but classicality, it is what is in between that we expect to be classical becomes degenerate. It is many and not one.
What does that mean though? Degenerate
path. By degenerate, I mean...
It doesn't sound classical in a sense. Like, would, like, say if you were able to implement this infinite slit, would you see a classical path or not?
Yes, just the space is compact. So
would you see one path or many? I mean, of course.
You would see many.
You would see many.
Yes. Because the beam can come directly from making a winding or making no winding, or just as a light beam, like pointing a laser from here in a compact space and observing here from the other point, it has many classical paths.
Just one extra thought to this is that you can have many solutions to, say, minimizing the action.
Mm-hmm.
If you take, for example, if you fix the initial and final,
yes,
final conditions, boundary conditions, that does not necessarily mean that all of those are realized, right?
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, for example, imagine a pendulum. If you fix the initial and final position, you can have many windings in between. You have like many solutions.
But it will still take one path.
But in the classical world,
mm-hmm,
it will take just one of them.
Okay.
There will be many solutions that will find,
mm-hmm,
in this, you know, minimizing the.
So, for example, you mean let's also measure the angle that this comes from.
For example, if,
mm-hmm,
you had the initial value formulation,
yes,
then you would find only one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Mm. I don't know. We can talk about it later.
So
maybe.
It just seems to me like it's not clear what the interpretation of this should be. Maybe making the analogy with this example,
mm-hmm,
I'm not sure what I would expect. Would I expect many paths or one path? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. What I said was that there are many possible classical paths, but you are asking which of them are all of them realized at the same time, or is it still one of? Is it going to be one of them that is?
That's my question.
Mm-hmm.
What would you see if you, if that was your description of the?
I don't know. I haven't thought about it.
That's a good question. I mean, in physics, you have the both possibility. The first one is symmetry breaking. You see only one possibility. The other example is gravitational lensing. The same galaxy is represented many ways in your vision of eyes because lights travel many paths.
Yeah.
I mean, each photon travels only one path, but what you see is many. So both, gravitational lensing is an example of multiple images of the same object because of the many classical paths. But symmetry breaking is also another very important phenomenon that you choose one possibility.
Any other questions?
One more question. I have a question. What is meta about the metaparticles? where does the name come from? Or maybe meta.
The name comes from meta strings, which is generalizing the string theory to a dynamical phase space as the target space, and meta particles is also that the space that this lives on, the fields live in, is a doubled space, or you can call it a phase space, with some section conditions.
But they would still be particles in,
yes,
like the standard.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So what is meta?
They're not really
important. No.
They are non-local. They are non-local.
Yeah, I mean the notion of particle is also like a bit like.
Yes.
Like they are not.
I mean.
They are not like higher order particles.
No. The notion of particle is usually tied up to the notion of space, right? It's impossible to talk about matter without. So if you change what you call geometry, you have to kind of rethink from the ground up what you would call matter.
Yeah.
I mean, depending on your culture, one is more fundamental. I don't know. You know, everybody sits on one side of the fence. For some people, matter is more fundamental than geometry. For some other people, geometry is more fundamental than matter. Everybody fights about it.
Why should we fight about it?
We should not, but that's the reality today. When you have different fields that have different... that's the attempt of not fighting about it.
Yeah,
it's to define the geometry by incorporating... I mean, trying to think about it in a unified manner. But the reality is that today, all the fields in quantum gravity have chosen a side. I mean, historically, it's because... been very important to either take the side of particle physics or take the side of geometry. It's been very present in the way you've been trained.
True.
That it's one or the other, and across history you see this pendulum going back. I mean, today people say everything is the field, so there's no longer particle, right? So this is the modern point of view, but it's going to swing back. It's I agree. It's maybe time now to just stop trying to choose a camp and put them together, which is what quantum gravity is supposed to do.
Okay, there are no more questions. Thanks yet again.